Hi friends, how are you all doing? Happy May! I cannot believe spring's in full bloom and summer is soon arriving. I have been seeing everyone in the city walking with tank tops and shorts, and I love to see it. Gone are the days of the ashy legs after a long day of leg warmers and heavy pants due to the cold weather. Everyone's so loud and proud. Well, maybe not everyone. For example, my mom is very open about her reluctance to wear shorts because she's so conscious of her legs having varicose veins. Ever heard of them? I call them the nurse's disease because I think I'm developing them too. Varicose veins are bulging, large veins commonly seen in the legs, caused by many things like age, pregnancy, being overweight, having obesity, or standing for long periods of time. These varicose veins look blue and twisted and stretched, and many even call them spider veins. Veins return blood from the rest of our body, like our legs, back to the heart, versus the arteries that carry blood from the heart to the rest of the body. But to return the blood to the heart, the veins in the legs must work against gravity. And our veins have valves, or like doors, that prevent the backflow of blood. Sometimes, these veins get weak and damaged, and then the blood can flow backward, and pull in the veins, they get twisted and stretch and poof, varicose veins. Obviously, for my mom and others, varicose veins and leg discoloration are a cosmetic concern, but they can also result in leg pain and discomfort, and they can be a sign of something deeper and more worrisome. But our veins are just one facet of our vasculature, our arteries, capillaries, and even lymphatic vasculature. Did you know that according to the National Institute of Aging, if we stretched out our arteries, veins, and capillaries as adults, they would measure around 100,000 miles. This means that our blood vessels could circle the globe 4 times, given that the Earth's circumference is about 25,000 miles. The human vasculature is truly an intricate system that literally supplies us with blood, with life. It is no surprise that pathologies and disease processes that involve our vasculature can result in life-threatening effects, like heart attacks and strokes, from coronary vascular and cerebral vascular disease, respectively. But these are the big and feared ones. We view these as potential death sentences. But other diseases of the vasculature may not seem as terrifying and a life at peril status as these. Still, they can definitely alter somebody's quality of life because of the diminished comfort and ability to live out their life to the fullest. For example, the cosmetic aspect of varicose veins that can hinder one from wearing the clothes they want. Potential leg amputation due to limb ischemia from untreated peripheral artery disease, or PAD, requiring the eventual need for hemodialysis due to chronic kidney disease from renal artery stenosis, impotence and erectile dysfunction from genitourinary vascular disease, and the list goes on and on. I actually work at an interventional cardiology and vascular surgery hybrid practice, where we do arterial and venous endovascular procedures, and I see these every day. Actually, just yesterday at work, we had to send a patient to the hospital for leg amputation because of an unsalvageable limb after multiple events over years of procedures. Before leaving, he told me, "I woke up today hoping I'd go home, but now I'm on my way to losing my leg. You can't really anticipate life," he said. And hearing that from him really made my heart sink. And I hear of other anecdotes from my patients, like former athletes who can no longer run because of PAD and grandmothers who cannot walk with their grandkids because of leg pain. Okay, enough of the long introduction. I have the biggest honor of being joined by Dr. Yang Yang, a fifth year and final year vascular surgery resident physician, to speak about all things vasculature and the surgical interventions they do to hopefully alleviate these pains, from PAD to deep vein thrombosis or DVT, and EV fistulas for hemodialysis, to carotid endarterectomies, to aortic aneurysms and dissections, you name it. We have a lot to talk about, and it won't be in vain. You get it? Vain, like V-A-I-N and V-E-I-N. Anyways, have a nice day, everyone. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining me after work.
Yeah, of course. Yes. I'm in scrubs.
Oh my God.
That's how it goes.
Well, thank you so much for joining me after a tiring day at work. I've been looking forward. I mean, honestly, I've been wanting to ask you for a year now.
Oh, really?
You could join me in a while. I was like, it'll come, and it's finally here. If you could just first please introduce yourself to everybody. Thank you.
Sure. So hi, everyone. First, thanks for inviting me to be a part of this. I'm very excited. My name's Yang. I'm a fifth year integrated vascular surgery resident based in DC. Year five means that I'm finally in my final year of training. So that's right. Only 10 months ago, but who's counting?
Who's counting? I mean, wow, that's such a short time of training. Short time of school and training, just, you know, over a decade of your life, right? Well, I'm so excited for you. You know, we first connected here online, and since then I've been watching your endovascular cases, your favorite femoral cases or whatever. And I was like, we need to talk about this because I work in an interventional cardiology and vascular surgeon's office, where we do
about recently. How did I know before?
Right? Yeah, so that's why I always comment on your stories. Like, I don't like femorals. You know, the world of vascular surgery, the field is just so extensive. Even when we were planning this whole live with the questions, we're like, okay, we can take that out. This is too big of a topic.
And so many things to talk about.
But first, I want to talk about you and your journey to medicine. You're such an inspiration to me and to so many other people. I wanted to know how your journey to medicine looked like throughout the years, and also what's the inspiration in pursuing this field? Is it like a family member, a friend, or personal experience?
Sure. So my grandfather was a doctor, but no one else really in my family was a doctor. So I kind of just found it on my own. I kind of had an inkling in high school that maybe that this is something I wanted to do. I was like, I like science. I kind of want to be in something where I'm helping people and I'm kind of talking to people. So it just kind of seemed to match up. I did go ahead then and I went and got my EMT certification. Mm-hmm. So I was an EMT for my local town and then also in college. So when I was pre-med, I was also an EMT. And then after that, you know, I did the usual like shadowing, like, you know, all the interest groups and stuff like that. So actually for a while, I thought I was going to go into emergency medicine just because that was like so much of what I knew between like EMT and kind of, you know, work at ER and stuff like that. So I took some time between college and medical school. I took about 2 years to kind of get all my letters and prep and everything because I did commit during college, but I needed to retake my MCAT and I needed to, what I felt like, get stronger letters. So I took some time to be able to do all of that. And then I got into medical school after a lot of studying, and I'm sure everyone knows what that's like. And then vascular surgery just kind of like came to me. It was very, very unexpected. Like I said, I thought I was going to go into emergency medicine, but it's really funny because they're completely opposite. And I don't think I could ever, ever do emergency medicine knowing myself now. So I did a general surgery rotation as a third year, and it kind of started because I had done OBGYN and I was like, oh, I think I like being in the operating room. Like maybe I should consider something like that, which kind of really limited what I was focused on. And then for a little bit, I thought about anesthesia, just because everyone's like, yeah, you know, if you want a life, you shouldn't do surgery, yada, 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 you know, like the things that everyone hears, and like, especially girls, we always hear. So I tried to convince myself to like anesthesia, which was a mistake, because it's nothing like, just because you're in the OR doesn't mean that it's anything close to surgery. Yeah. So that wasn't for me. And then I had done a couple of vascular cases. And at the time, I was like, I like being in the OR, but I don't really like belly stuff. I don't like hernias. I don't like lap chole's. I don't like anything foregut, midgut, anything. And then when I scrubbed vascular cases, I was like, oh, what's this? Yeah, so that was very eye-opening. That was really, really lucky, honestly. I went to Drexel for medical school. We didn't have a dedicated vascular department. So it was really just like lucky that this happened to me. My chief resident at the time in general surgery was also going to vascular for fellowship. You know, it just takes one person. So she saw that I had an inkling and she was like, hey, like, come with me to do this bypass, or come with me to do this EVAR, like, go like see this patient and tell me what you think. And, you know, the more involved I think we are as medical students anyways, the more of an interest we have. And so she really kind of like took me under. And then that's when I discovered there's like a whole integrated pathway similar to like plastic surgery, but there's still an option for general surgery as well. And then you kind of do fellowship afterwards. So I debated for a while because I found vascular like March of my third year, which is a little late. Yeah. So I didn't have a home program, meaning I didn't have like a chair or a chief or like a program director to kind of help me. So I didn't end up picking a researcher at Penn State. And I did a lot of research then. I did a bunch of conferences, networked my little butt off. Then I did away rotations, which are really important in vascular surgery. And then ultimately I matched here at DC. So very happy to be here and very happy to be almost done.
I can't imagine 10 months. Who's counting?
Yeah.
But anyway, well, such a long road, right? With a lot of ups and downs, and even just the whole medical school application process, such an emotional toll, and so many other things involved. And I can't imagine, you know, like the whole medical school round and the residency and all of those things. Yeah. I mean, especially here in the United States, right? The whole medical route entails so many sacrifices, right? Whether it's financial or time or effort. And it's great to hear that, you know, you found something that you really love doing, right? Which I guess took trial and rotations and shadowing. Mm-hmm. Do you think at this point in your medical journey, given all of the time, the sacrifices, all the entailed sacrifices in whatever aspect of life, there may be, do you have any regrets in pursuing this field at all?
I think overall, no. I'm very happy with what I'm capable of, both in and out of the operating room. I'm very proud of what I'm able to do, and I feel very confident in my skills. I do think that residency as a whole is very challenging, so there's definitely been days where I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, I've been here since 5 a.m. I'm leaving at 10 p.m. I haven't seen my husband for like 3 weeks. Like, I'm just like a slob on weekends. You know, there's definitely challenging times. And I think you kind of have to keep like the big picture in mind, at least for me when that happens. I don't regret it as of like this moment right now. Obviously, I have yet to become an attending and kind of like get to the final stage, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel, whatever you want to call it. But right now, as of this moment, I don't really regret it. That being said, I do think that I had to really take a good hard look at what was important to me and like learn how to prioritize things. Mm-hmm. So I would say that maybe sometimes I'm not as social in residency as I would like, because I either have to do research, or I promised my husband I would do something with him, or my parents are in town. And, you know, everything is like give and take. And so, you know, there have been instances where I'm not maybe the best resident because I have to try and be a better daughter, or I'm not a good wife because I'm trying to be a better resident. It's just kind of all like ebbs and flows. And my husband will do the same exact thing that sometimes I just ignore. But overall, no major regrets so far. And I'm very happy with my decision.
Wow. I love that. And I'm so honored that after a long day of work, you're here right now.
I will be totally honest and say that I'm on a lighter rotation right now. And my junior resident is very, very capable. So I have like somewhat normal hours.
I love it. You know, speaking more about surgery and vascular surgery, I wanted to pull up the statistic that the American Board of Surgery has on their website. They said that only 14% of board certified vascular surgeons are women. I feel like you've known for a while, for so long, from the beginning, that when medicine as a whole is a male-dominated field, specifically the field of surgery, right, is a very male-dominated field. And as you get into even more niche subspecialties, like for the last season, we had Dr. Fanny Milhouse, who's a pelvic surgeon, neurologist. Like, I feel like only 4% was the statistic we saw that were female reconstructive and urological surgeons. For vascular surgery, it's 14%, which is such a small percentage, right? Given that, do you think being a woman in medicine and a woman in vascular surgery, has it affected, you think, your experience as a resident physician, as a resident surgeon? And how do you think we can increase this number from 14% to even bigger rates for vascular surgery?
Yeah, I think that I've been very fortunate because my program currently is half females. Endings are maybe, I would say, a third female. So we're getting there. The latest ACGME data shows that 50% of the applicants who are applying to vascular surgery are women. So we're kind of making moves. I do feel like I sometimes either have to prove myself a little bit more or conduct myself in a certain way that perhaps my male residents don't necessarily have to do. You know, for example, when men throw tantrums in the OR, it's like, oh, that's just a surgeon's personality. And then when like women be more demanding or stuff like that, then it's like, oh, she's such a, you know what, like she's so whatever. And there's always this like condescending tone to it. The other challenge then I think that a lot of women struggle with is then you try to be too nice. And if you try to be too nice, and they feel like they can walk all over you, and there's just no like kind of winning. So I do think that, you know, it's a lot of introspection where this is coming from. I've been very fortunate that no one has, at least in recent years, outwardly said anything to me about being, you know, a female in a surgical field. I do think that kind of all of the recent publications about how like more than half of the students in medical school are girls now, and how you know, there's like social media to highlight all of this and lots of accounts highlighting, you know, kind of women in surgery. It's gotten a lot better. I think in medical school and maybe, oh my God, like 10 years ago at this point, it was much, much more different because when I was applying, I remember a lot, you know, I only had male surgeons who were supposed to kind of help mentor me. And my medical school kind of person who was supposed to be helping me was like, are you sure you like vascular? Like, are you sure that's right for you? Kind of with this undertone of like, you're too nice. Like maybe you can't handle it. And it's always backhanded comments like that, right? People are always like, you're too nice to be a surgeon. And I'm like, I just don't understand what that means. Cause why wouldn't anybody want a nice surgeon? Like nice and capable are not exclusive. So anyways, all of that to say that I do think that there are challenges and I think been a little bit fortunate in terms of not having to experience so overt sexism. Mm-hmm. But I do still think that we have a long way to go. And unfortunately, I do still feel like women really have to kind of carry themselves in a certain way so you don't rock the boat. And it's really hard to make changes until you're kind of at the top. And so that's kind of why I think women in leadership, women, you know, promoting other women and men promoting other women into positions of power, that's how you can really get change. You know, that's one of the things that I'm passionate about. I think that's why it's important to have kind of like domains like social media, like, you know, Twitter, and even like just these like conferences that pop up that have sessions dedicated to women. It's kind of not just a safe space, but also a place for everybody to kind of talk about things and come up with ideas and, you know, think about how to make things better for everybody. Because I don't think that people should be selected based on their gender or their sex, but I do have to acknowledge the fact that like there is an inherent bias, I think, especially in surgery when it comes to having a male versus female surgeon. And I think that's something that we are very much so trying to make better.
Yeah, I love all of that. I love all of that. I mean, even this podcast series that we have, right? Like, it's our third season right now, and we're over 80 expert guests right now.
You're doing so great. This is so awesome.
Thank you. And over 70% of our guests are women in medicine, right? Because I think it's so important to tell those stories, right? That we can turn the tide even on a small screen like social media, right? And thank you for being so present on social media too. I mean, it's just so inspiring seeing your journey and just this boss, badass woman who's on Instagram, you know? And yeah, so it's such an honor. And I think it also brings to light that like any field in medicine can be open to anybody, right? Even I find vascular surgery to be such a niche field, right? Like, we've always had arteries and veins and capillaries, but I feel like it's only recently that I'm hearing more and more about like really focused education on the vasculature, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're the expert here, you're the vascular surgery resident. Can you take us to the basics? What is the premise of this whole field of vascular surgery? Like, why do I need to see a vascular surgeon versus a cardiac surgeon who also deals supposedly with the circulatory system?
Right? Yeah. No, those are all great questions. And I actually didn't even know it was a specialty until I was like a third year myself. So, and even sometimes my dad will be like, oh yeah, you work with the heart, right? And I'll be like, no, dad, it's not the same thing. but no, vascular surgery, the way they define it and the way we define it is that we are dedicated to the arteries and veins of the body, excluding the brain and excluding the heart. Obviously, because like things like the coronary arteries and stuff are dedicated to cardiac surgery, and then neurosurgery, obviously, for anything intracranial. So we'll do extracranial things like carotids, obviously, as you know, vertebral, subclavians, and then anything of the heart is kind of for CT surgery. So then you kind of break it down into, you know, arteries, what kind of diseases happen there, and then veins, what kind of diseases happen there, and then slowly we kind of start to segue in that way. A lot of vascular surgery, I think, is kind of difficult for people to think about because it's really a majority of our patient population, especially for arterial disease, is of an older population. So, you know, it's not really something where people our age or people on social media or something would kind of really be actively talking about. And especially when we start to think about things like PAD and aneurysms and stuff like that, it's always like over 50, over 60. You will see a little bit more of like the venous stuff, especially superficial venous, like spider veins, varicose veins, and stuff like that. But those, sometimes the other specialties will also treat them. So like interventional radiology sometimes will do like deep system reflux. Dermatology will inject spider veins, you know, plastic surgery will do like veins and stuff like that as well. But you're right, like it's not really like very, very well known out there. And people aren't like, oh, you need to go see a vascular surgeon the same way that they're like, you need to go see a heart doctor.
Yeah.
People don't really know what it is.
Yeah.
I often wish I had perfect vision. There is so much intricacy in life and beauty in the world around me that I often miss because my view can get so blurry. Though I had glasses for years, I opted never to wear them because of the embarrassing indentations and marks they left behind on my face. Kovri seeks to target this common struggle within the eyewear market. Kovri is a 100% AAPI woman-owned inclusive eyewear brand designed for comfort, offering a wide range of sunwear and specs with prescription lens options. With their signature elevated fit that features longer nose pads, a reduced frame curvature, and a narrow nose bridge to elevate the frame, Kovri is designed to better complement diverse facial features such as low nose bridges and high cheekbones for an effortless fit. Beyond this, the premium handcrafted frames are made from plant-based acetate and lenses with 100% UV protection. Find your perfect fit with their offers of a home and virtual try-on. With the code FRANZ, that's FRANZ, you can get $20 off any frame you like on shopkovri.com. See the world's beauty more comfortably with Kovri. This offer is valid in one frame per order, cannot be combined with any other offers, and is limited to one use per customer. There are luxuries in life that see beyond material things. Practices like self-care and skincare can be an oasis in the whirlwinds and busyness of life. But what if there exists a harmony between material and immaterial luxuries? House of M Beauty is a saffron-infused luxury skincare line that harnesses the antioxidant, vitamin C-rich, anti-inflammatory, and antibacterial power of the highest quality medicinal-grade saffron. They are a clean treatment skincare line suitable for sensitive and postpartum skin. Their unique and consciously crafted formulations maximize the potency of medicinal saffron to calm and soothe sensitive skin while brightening and targeting skin concerns. From their skin polish, to the Miracle Serum, to the Glow Jelly Mask, and the Silk Night Concentrate, experience the luxurious transformation saffron can bring to your skin with the code FRANZ20, that's FRANZ20, for 20% off your first order on houseofmbeauty.com. Also available at Nordstrom nationwide. As a nurse, I am on my feet, alert for 12 hours or more each day. There is no space for drowsiness or lethargy in my job because my patient's well-being is at stake. Sometimes, you just need the extra energy boost from coffee. Robusta coffee offers 2 times more caffeine and antioxidants with 60% less sugar. But did you know that thanks to its climate and fertile volcanic soil, Vietnam is the world's 2nd largest coffee producer and the number 1 grower of Robusta? Nguyen Coffee Supply is America's first specialty, woman-owned Vietnamese coffee company set to change the future of coffee through sustainability, diversity, and inclusion. The only roast coffee beans are hand-picked at peak ripeness from direct trade Vietnamese farms to produce sweet and flavorful coffee without any additives, flavorings, or oils. Get your own velvety coffee experience for 15% off your order with the code FRANZ15, that's FRANZ15, at NguyenCoffeeSupply.com.
And I feel like with the intersection of different fields and specialties, right, like say interventional radiologists or interventional cardiologists, like they would do probably some procedures that vascular surgeons always do, right? Or like you said with derms, like doing sclerotherapy maybe for venous varices. It's kind of like, it's like when you feel something in your body, right? Like, which kind of doctor do I see for this? Like, do I see this doctor? Do I see? Because I feel like there's also like a intermeshing of so many things, right? But the star tonight is the vascular surgery. And so I wanted to veer more into your daily life as a vascular surgery resident. I guess take us to a bread and butter of your work, especially in your training for the past 5 years. It probably changes, you know, every year as you go into a different residency year. But what would you say are the most common procedures that you would do? Like, you would go into the hospital today and you'll be like, or, you know, when you prepare your patient list the night before or whatnot, your case list, it's like you already know in your mind, oh, I'm going to see this, this, and this. What would be, you think, your top 3 procedures that
So since we're talking mostly in a hospital setting, I'll just mostly talk about like inpatient things. So a lot of that will be arterial. So one of the most common things that we treat would be a peripheral arterial disease. And I just have to make a plug because September is supposed to be PAD Awareness Month, which the Society for Vascular Surgery is trying very hard to promote. But it's basically peripheral arterial disease, meaning it's the same kind of atherosclerotic disease that you see in coronaries when people think about like heart attacks and stuff like that. But the important thing to kind of differentiate and remember uterus, that it also happens in your extremities, and for a lot of people, most commonly in their lower extremities. So a lot of kind of what colloquially we'll say for vascular is like, oh, today's like a leg day, meaning that we're either going to do like angiograms, which is just a sort of like minimally invasive procedure where you enter near the femoral artery, your favorite, to get access and do some kind of endovascular intervention. So, you know, the angiograms that we do, they're usually in a hybrid room, or you have like a C-arm where you use contrast and fluoroscopy or x-ray machine, kind of put the contrast inside the vessels and the vessels light up. And depending on how things look and kind of a combination of some other techniques that we use, we'll be able to tell if you have any narrowing in your blood vessels or not, or even any blockages. And depending on how that looks, we'll either be able to treat it endovascularly with like a balloon or a stent, or we'll say, you know, this is not a good pathology to treat endovascular, and then we'll think about something open, meaning bypass, endarterectomy, et cetera, et cetera. PAD is one of the biggest things that we do treat, and that can obviously be further classified into like the Kulim ischemia, you know, there's a Kulim ischemia, chronic ischemia, all that stuff. But that's just kind of like, you know, leg day, PAD, it's very, very prevalent. A lot of people have it, and it's something that we see quite often. Top three, that's hard. I would say we don't do it as much at my training program, but most vascular surgeons across the country will do dialysis access. That's considered bread and butter. So when we're talking about, specifically, we do hemodialysis, so not peritoneal dialysis, but hemodialysis where they, you know, you go to a center and you're hooked up to a machine 3 days a week. So we'll do fistula creations, or we'll do graft creations. And then kind of the maintenance for those, we'll do fistulograms and kind of, you know, banding or ligation or anything else that's kind of related to dialysis access. That's another big thing that we do. And the last one, it would have to be between like carotid disease and aortic disease, which is also like another huge topic. So aortic disease, meaning like aneurysms, dissections, ruptures, intramural hematomas, any type of like acute aortic syndrome, we do a good amount of those as well. So those that have veered more towards an endovascular approach nowadays, we don't do so much open just because of kind of the technology that's out there and kind of patient recovery and all that stuff. So those come by pretty often, which is good for training. You know, there definitely are more complex cases and the cases that everybody wants to be involved in. And then, you know, finally, we have carotid disease, like symptomatic or asymptomatic carotid artery stenosis, carotid artery aneurysms, carotid body tumors, lots of other things that we tackle. But I would say probably carotid artery stenosis is probably the most common out of all those pathologies, kind of with the same risk factors that everyone else has for like CAD and PAD, you know, making sure that we can try and prevent stroke as much as we can. And then we kind of talk into like, and then we kind of go into, you know, TCAR, which is very popular now, which is kind of the transcarotid stenting. And then there's also the good old carotid endarterectomy, which everybody loves. Yeah.
Yeah. I love all of that. I mean,
it's a lot.
It's a disclaimer. I know. Disclaimer. I love all of my patients, even the femoral ones. But I must say that when your blood pressure goes down to 40 over 30, I'm not that excited. You know? I mean, I think also with, I guess, with medical technology and scientific advancements, right? I guess before, the gold standard and the only option was just femoral, right? I mean, now seeing, let's say, more of pedal access through anterior tibial or posterior tibial, or it's just like, or peroneal access as well. It's just so interesting to see just how medicine, you know, takes its strides in these diseases that probably were once death sentences, or like sentences where people was like, oh, you can't walk anymore. Oh, we have to amputate this extremity, right? Or even, I can't even imagine, like, before the days where we invented, I don't know, interventions for, like, a DVT and stuff like that. And it's just waiting there and just waiting for someone to get a stroke, right? Well, speaking of a DVT, I mean, what are the vascular surgery interventions for, let's say, a DVT or even, let's say, a pulmonary embolism?
Yeah, so DVT and pulmonary embolism is actually a very like hot new topic right now, because it's also covered by interventional cardiology and interventional radiology, as you probably know. So vascular surgery is also kind of gaining a lot of traction on that. A lot of what has been coming out for DVT and PE is thrombectomies, but these are all done endovascular, so minimally invasive, where we access the veins directly. And then we have a series of catheters or thrombectomy devices where we basically use it to remove the clot. So for a DVT, we have options depending on the kind of underlying pathology as to why the patient has a DVT in the first place. We have technology with the catheters now to either kind of suck out the clot directly. So it's like a big catheter, maybe like this wide, you know, 16 French, 18 French, whatever. And it's just using negative pressure just sucks out the clot. And then depending on how that looks, if the patient has like May Thurner syndrome or something like that, then there's consideration for stenting. And then if they've had like previous IVC filters and their IVC is now narrowed and stuff like that, there's also options for stenting as well. So that's kind of DVT. The thing that we used to do, which we've kind of moved away from, at least at my institution, is thrombolysis. Mm-hmm. So where you put TPA in a catheter and you kind of let the TPA just drift out into the clot. And that requires an ICU stay because it's such a scary medication for risk of bleeding. So we'll lyse patients and then we'll bring them back the next day to kind of finish everything. We will also lyse PEs, but we've also kind of moved away from that. At least our institution, we have pretty good devices for removing clots. So we'll, you know, access the femoral veins, get into the IVC, cross the heart, get into the pulmonary arteries, and literally just like suck out clot. It's very, very popular right now. It's very hot, very exciting. If you look on Twitter, there's all these things called like clot porn, and people are so into that, which is like a whole thing on its own.
Oh my God.
You're like, look at the clot I got out today. And they like make it in a heart. It's really weird. But people really like it because that's the other thing, right? Like, they yeah, people are doing that to themselves on Twitter. But in all seriousness, it is very satisfying to be able to, you know, have a patient feel better and be able to show them a picture of like, look at what was inside of you and like, look at what we took out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when we talk about something like pulmonary embolism, right, where it's a little bit closer to more vital organs like the heart and the lungs, right? I think even when we talk about it, and I guess the general public, and someone said Zoom med school lecture, hello, sign your attendance. But anyways, so when we're talking something like PE, right, where it's kind of so much closer and it's in the vital organs, it can bring a lot more tension and fear, right? Like, okay, we can get a heart attack or you can get a stroke. But when we're talking about things like the peripheral things, like peripheral artery disease or even like chronic venous insufficiency and or varicose veins, the sense of urgency may not be there, right? Because it's peripheral, it's the extremities. Mm-hmm. It's not something the general public might see as more life-threatening, let's say, as again, as a PE that can lead to whatever, right? As a vascular surgeon who treats, you know, an array of these things from a PE to carotid endarterectomy to PAD, how urgent do you think patients should be when it comes to seeking help for more peripheral diseases like PAD or
I think that the PAD is a little bit more challenging because no one's gonna say like, I feel like I have PAD, I feel like I have claudication, I feel like I have rest pain, right? In the same way that when people have like a heart attack or they're having chest pain, right, they have their symptoms and they'll allude it to a diagnosis. So they'll be like, I have chest pain, oh my God, maybe I'm having a heart attack. But you're right, peripheral doesn't kind of exude the same amount of urgency, right? If someone's like, let's just take the PAD example, if someone's like, you know, my legs hurt when I walk, and that's, you know, something that we will say claudication, the patient's not going to be like, I think I have PAD. People are going to be like, maybe it's arthritis, maybe I pulled something, you know? And the same thing with like rest pain and stuff like that. And so I think that's why it's important to have a lot more public knowledge out there, especially for older patients, about kind of what can happen. Because the thing with PAD that we always worry about is like mortality, amputation, limb loss, right? And not to say that people who have leg pain are going to, you know, head down the road to amputation or anything like that. But, you know, there's a very, very large differential. And I think patients just need to be more aware of kind of what the possibilities are. And it's just something because of like kind of how our society is, how like TV has sensationalized medicine. You know, PAD is not sexy. It's not exciting. Like the most reference I've ever seen for PAD was on like a K-drama where someone had diabetes and they're like, you need to get it under control or else your toes are going to be amputated. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that is surprisingly accurate. But that's the only thing I've ever seen for PAD ever. Yeah. Everything else, though, like PEs, you know, heart attacks, strokes and stuff. When people have a stroke, they don't think about carotid disease, right? People think about like, oh, like something's going on in my brain. They don't think about like the arteries that are feeding the brain. And that's not to say that all strokes have a carotid etiology or even, you know, anything extracranial, but it's just something that's not really, really kind of at the forefront of everyone's minds.
Yeah, super agree with all that. I mean, You're right. It's not as, I guess, as sexy. It's not as glorified, right? But even when you were talking about, let's say, like, provocation or leg pain, no one in the general public would be like, oh, I'm getting cramping in my legs. I have PAD.
I have poor blood flow. Yeah.
Yeah. People will be like, I didn't eat enough bananas. My potassium is out of whack, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
It's nothing too, I guess, starry-eyed, right. As opposed to PE or like a heart attack.
Right.
Or a stroke. We talk a lot now about the legs and mm-hmm. and more of the peripheral stuff. And you said in the beginning that kind of vascular surgery kind of excludes mostly, I guess, the brain and the heart.
Mm-hmm.
But you do things like very close to cerebral vascular. And you mentioned some earlier. What would be your, I guess, most favorite surgery to do when it comes to chest up, I would say?
Chest up. So it used to be a carotid endarterectomy. There's not a lot of options for chest up. Depends on where you're defining as chest, because then we could talk about like upper extremity bypasses,
stuff like that.
Those are fine. Carotid subclavian bypasses. Those are a good case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're talking about like the ascending and kind of the arch vessels, that gets to be more CT surgery a little bit. But anything above the chest, it's probably going to be a carotid endarterectomy. I mean, that was just like the first case that got me into vascular. It's very delicate, very refined. It's great anatomy. Like almost everyone knows what a carotid endarterectomy is. It's like the most pimpable question in the OR. Like students love it, attendings love it.
For the general public who may not know even what carotid means, can you explain what that procedure
means? Sure. So carotid endarterectomy is just where you make an incision kind of along your neck. You're looking at the carotid arteries that go up to your brain. There's the common carotid, internal carotid, and the external carotid. We care the most about the internal carotid because that feeds the brain. And so if you have areas of narrowing with like plaque and disease, the carotid endarterectomy is done to prevent future strokes. So essentially, we open up your neck right here along your sternocleidomastoid. We isolate out all of your carotid vessels. We get control to make sure there's not bleeding, and we literally scoop out the plaque. It doesn't always come easy, but you know, my attending used to say you get style points, you get all the plaque out in one piece. So it's usually very, very calcified, very, very hard and solid. Sometimes it'll be a little bit more soft. You see that mostly in patients who have had recent strokes where their atheroma has like ruptured. That's what's causing their symptoms. But the carotid endarterectomy is just a nice surgery. It's a nice case. I think, you know, it's just like very satisfying to do. It's very fun.
I feel like some people watching here who are not in medicine are like, how?
It's better if I had like a whiteboard to like draw right here.
An actual Zoom medical lecture. You know, you also mentioned earlier about dissections and aneurysms. Actually, I got a few questions in my DMs when I was promoting our lives from students asking to differentiate what an aneurysm is and a dissection is, and I guess what intervention a vascular surgeon would do.
Oh, sure. So there are two very different disease pathologies. An aneurysm is a weakening in the vessel wall. And so essentially what happens is that you think of it like as a balloon. When there's weakening, then it tends to expand, and it keeps getting bigger. And the thing we worry about most with an aneurysm is the risk of rupture, because when it ruptures, it's a very, very high mortality. It's like 50% of patients don't make it to the hospital and will die. That's like a very broad overview. So that's specifically aortic aneurysms. You can have aneurysms anywhere in your body. You can have carotid aneurysms, you can have femoral artery aneurysms, you know, anywhere. But for aortic aneurysms, you know, I assume that's what they're talking about, because then when you lead into dissection, aortic dissection, that's just when you have a tear in the vessel wall. And so what will then happen is, instead of your aorta being one nice tube where the blood is flowing, it creates a channel where we'll call it true lumen and false lumen. That's what we're calling it. And then true lumen is kind of where normal, healthy blood vessel is and kind of where everything is flowing the way it should be. And then the false lumen is basically another plane where blood is going. And depending on the area of dissection and what kind of end organs that's feeding, that can lead to a variety of different symptoms. And so dissections most days now is fixed endovascular. Aortic aneurysms, depending on where they are and kind of whether they're elective or if they're emergent because they rupture, can be open or endovascular. And there's all these things that we need to know about, like, you know, criteria for fixing aneurysms and what stent graft is good for what and stuff like that. And for dissections, like I said, it's mostly endovascular at this point.
Being in scrubs the whole shift and for days at work can sometimes strip you of your sense of fashion and self-expression. But instilling a bit of design and color does not hurt to let your personality shine through your uniform. V-Coterie is a leading provider of healthcare jewelry and accessories for playful everyday wear, from pins to badge jewel charms and medical specialty-specific necklaces. With their creative process paralleling the founder's background in dentistry, V-Coterie was founded to spark the genius within you, redefining the traditional boundaries for jewelry and accessories. They believe fashion can celebrate curiosity and the pursuit of knowledge while allowing you to express your truest self. From the curious student, to a confident clinician, or even a kidney transplant survivor, V-Coterie is here to celebrate you no matter where the journey takes you. Get 15% off your first order with the code VFriendsOfFrons on VCoterie.com. Find your daily dose of style and make your passion your fashion. As someone with acne-prone skin, I always fear using new moisturizers that may be too heavy on my skin and clog my pores. This is why I love my Aloe Quench by Skin by Anthos, a facial moisturizer made for all skin types, especially for sensitive skin like mine. Made with an oil-free formula using aloe, glycerin, and green tea, it is suitable for acne-prone, oily, or combination skin. Its soothing and paraben-free formula makes it even great for sunburns and patients taking Accutane. Skin by Anthos is the byproduct of the minds and expertise of board-certified dermatology professionals and proud AAPI mothers who saw the need for access to pharmaceutical strength and professional-grade skincare for those with sensitive skin and/or skin of color from the safety and convenience of home. Experience a regimen tailored to your skin type that is strong enough to deliver medical-grade results for 20% off with the code FRONZPODCAST when you order on skinbyanthos.com. The sense of taste is so intriguing. A cascade of good memories can wash over you as you experience the flavor you have met before. Founded by Hannah Bae, Halmi, a loving nickname for grandma in Korean, it's a brand of light sparkling beverages that evokes feelings of nostalgia for Koreans and Asians in general, but also curiosity if you are not familiar with certain ingredients and the story behind the flavors. Inspired by traditional Korean flavors through family recipes and made with real fruits and spices, Halmi's debut flavor, Cinnamon Ginger Jujube Persimmon, is a sparkling take on Korea's beloved sujongwa, a sweetened spice punch that has been brewed for generations to aid digestion and is shared during Korea's most festive moments. It's their version of a healthier, lighter ginger ale. With the code FRANZ, that's F-R-A-N-Z, you can get 15% off your first order on drinkhalmi.com. Partake in honoring roots, strengthening ancestral connections, and celebrating hyphenated identities with unique, refreshing, and better-for-you ingredients.
I'm very curious. I mean, the expanse of the type of surgeries you need to do, obviously it comes with a lot of preparation beforehand. And obviously, it takes a lot of practice and skill. I mean, that's what residency and training for, right? Take me to your brain when you're doing surgery, I guess. Or I guess this would be true for any other surgeon, right? How would one know the next step of what to do in a certain surgery? Is that just by practice and studying?
Yeah, I think everyone does it a little bit differently. And it also depends on if you're doing an elective, like a planned, nice outpatient case versus an emergency. But there's kind of standard steps and kind of an algorithm that everyone will eventually develop depending on what pathology you're treating. So I think it's, for me at least, the way I do it, and this was kind of what I did to transition from a junior resident to a senior resident, because obviously the expectations are a lot more. When I was a junior resident, I'd be like, oh, you kind of do this and you kind of do that. And like, if I take the example of the carotid endarterectomy, I'd be like, oh, you make an incision here and you do something, and then the IJ shows up and then carotid shows up and you sew and like you're done. But, you know, as a senior resident and kind of as everyone continues to progress and stuff like that, and especially for, you know, things like oral wards, I like to look at the relevant anatomy beforehand. There are textbooks that are like operative anatomy as opposed to just like netters where they list out every single organ. There's textbooks that are more dedicated to the operative steps as well as the operative anatomy. So it'll be like, you know, you find your landmarks and you have your earlobe, you know, your mandible and then your sternal notch. And then this is the length of the incision and it's much more technical. Whereas junior residents, I think you get more of a general idea of what the surgery entails. When you're a senior and I'm sure beyond, you know, what really helped me and the way I kind of do things now is I plan my cases the night before. Some of the cases, like angiograms, because they're both diagnostic and therapeutic, you don't really know exactly what you're going to do because you don't know where you're going to see when you get in there. But sometimes for the more open cases, it's a little bit more standard just because the anatomy is the anatomy. And I just know, like, if this, then that. And if I, like, open the carotid sheath, then this is what I expect to find. If I, like, dissect up this way, then this is what I expect to find. And so it just becomes, like, second nature in terms of, like, what you're expecting. And then I think also this is something that I'm still trying to work on, but you think 2 to 3 steps ahead. And then you also have to think about, like, okay, if this doesn't work or something is unexpected or out of my algorithm, how am I going to adapt and how am I going to adjust? And kind of like my attending said, like, you kind of have to have a plan B and a plan C at all times. And then he likes to joke that that's what he does all the time because he works with residents and we make his life hard, but that's okay. That's what training is all about. But yeah, that's how I do it, you know. For things that are more complex, like the complex endovascular cases, I will try to write out all of this stuff. You know, if it's like for an iliac artery aneurysm and we're doing like an EVAR plus an iliac branch device and it's much more like technically complicated, then I will literally write out the steps. Like, I'll use this wire, I'll use this catheter, I'm going to snare this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to like advance this sheath, exchange all that out. And so it really becomes like a step-by-step thought process for me. And then the more I review it, the more fluid it becomes.
You've shared so much a lot about different diseases and your interventions, and it's so educational, and it's just so interesting to see again how much we can do, especially now, right, to save people, right, and to hopefully alleviate the pain and all the symptoms they're feeling. Above all that, what would you say would be your favorite part about vascular surgery?
My favorite part about vascular surgery is I think that we have the ability to tackle almost anything, both in an endo and open manner. And our toolbox is very, 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 very large. So kind of like what you alluded to before, like, we have femoral access, we have radial access, we have pedal access now. We have so many like different ways of coming up with things. We can bypass to literally anything we wanted to, if we wanted to. It's just our ability to kind of tackle the disease process and kind of at least try to alleviate what's happening. We just have a lot of options. And we continue to, I think, advance the field. We have a lot of new technology coming out. So, you know, industry relationships with us is very, very exciting, something that I really like, because it's nice to have new devices and it's nice to, like, you know, kind of try and see what new things are out there and how we can, like, better, you know, help our patients and kind of advance the specialty as a whole. So I think from a technical standpoint and operative standpoint, I think vascular is one of the most unique and obviously greatest specialty out there, just because we're able to do a lot. You know, if our endovascular options fail, then we'll convert to open. We can do hybrid procedures. Like, I think there's a lot that we are able to do. And I really love that because it doesn't feel like anything is ever really routine. You know, there's always a little bit of complexity. There's always a little bit of like critical thinking, being creative. I attend a lot of conferences and I hear the attendings be like, well, I tried this and then this. And then me and my co-resident are like, what? They did what? Like, that is so crazy, but so smart at the same time. And it's just stuff like that that like really keeps me going because I just get like so excited about it. I think it's like so fun.
Yeah.
So I really love that.
Yeah, I love that. And with all of that, with all of the beauty of the field, you know, can also be really taxing, right? Not just emotionally, but also physically, especially being a physician and especially being a surgeon, right? Mm-hmm. Like, people's lives are literally in your hands in that moment, right? Blood loss, like extreme blood loss can happen, and I say femoral. So, I don't hate femoral though. Just a disclaimer, I don't hate it. It's just not my favorite. But anyways, through all of that, there can be a lot of toll on the physician. How do you decompress from all of this?
I think that I have different ways of decompressing depending on what the issue was. So if I just had a bad day at work because like residency sucks and like someone in the ICU is mean or whatever, like I'm overworked, whatever, then I just kind of play some Zelda, watch some TV, like hang out with my husband, just completely like step away from medicine. If there's been a bad patient outcome or a complication, then I handle it very differently. I'll call my co-resident to kind of talk over the case and be like, what do you think happened? Like, what do you think? You know, I'll talk to my attending. They are usually very good about being like, hey, like, let's talk about what happened and what we could have done better. I will call other attendings who weren't part of the case and just be like, what do you think happened? And so a lot of that just becomes like an educational, like, learning thing for me. And also, I think it's helpful to hear from people who have been through it and have seen a lot. And it's, you know, there's that saying, if you don't have complications, you don't operate enough. It's just, you know, inevitable, and things are going to happen. And I think it's good to talk to people who have been through it and kind of hear about how they like to process it and how they navigate some of the challenges. Because at the end of the day, like, the surgeries are great. Like, you know, I am very open about, like, how I love the technology and how I love operating. But at the end of the day, it's like you said, like, there's someone on the table, there's someone that we're trying to take care of. And it's very, very hard when things don't go the way that we plan them to. So I think it's important to have a good support system in place, you know, both in and out of, like, within your specialty. So I'll talk to, like, my mom, who's in medicine, but not in vascular surgery. And so sometimes that extra perspective will help a lot as well. But I think, you know, for that stuff, it's important to, like, reach out. It's important to kind of not just withdraw and try to, like, keep it all for yourself. Because there's someone out there who's seen it before.
I guess it's also helpful to have, like, try, I don't know how it is in residency, to have a life outside of medicine somehow too, right? Like, I guess hobbies and
at the cost of sleep, but still, very
important. Yeah, I agree. Dr. Yang, I learned so much today, and I'm so honored to have you on.
Having me. I'm honored to be here. You're on season three.
And it's such an honor to talk about one of my most favorite things, femoral artery access. I mean, like, how I cannot sleep. Literally, I cannot sleep. No, but I'm so honored, and thank you again for joining me. And this, I love this episode. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Of course. Have a great rest.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.